I pushed Jake's jaws apart, depressing his tongue with a forefinger, and shone the light into the depths. He was the kind of good-natured dog who offered no resistance as I prodded around, but despite my floodlit view of the pharynx, I could find nothing wrong. I'd been hoping desperately to come across a bit of bone stuck there somewhere, but I ranged feverishly over pink tongue, healthy tonsils, and gleaming molars without success. Everything looked perfect. I was tilting his head a little further when I felt him stiffen and heard Roddy's cry. "He's gone again!" And he was, too. I stared in horror as the brindled body slid away from me and lay prostrate once more on the table, and again the mouth strained wide and froth bubbled round the lips. As before, the breathing had stopped and the ribcage was motionless. As the seconds ticked away, I beat on the chest with my hand, but it didn't work this time. I pulled the lower eyelid down from the staring orb. The conjunctiva was blue. Jake hadn't long to live. The tragedy of the thing bore down on me. This wasn't just a dog. He was this man's family, and I was watching him die. It was at that moment that I heard the faint sound. It was a strangled cough which barely stirred the dog's lips. "Damn it!" I shouted. "He is choking! There must be something down there!" Again, I seized the head and pushed my torch into the mouth, and I shall always be thankful that at that very instant the dog coughed again, opening the cartilages of the larynx and giving me a glimpse of the cause of all the trouble. There, beyond the drooping epiglottis, I saw for a fleeting moment a smooth, round object no bigger than a pea. "I think it's a pebble," I gasped. "Right inside his larynx."
"You mean in his Adam's apple?"
"That's right, and it's acting like a ball valve, blocking his windpipe every now and then." I shook the dog's head. "You see, look, I dislodged it for the moment. He's coming round again." Once more, Jake was reviving and breathing steadily. Roddy ran his hand over the head, along the back and down the great muscles of the hind limbs. But it'll happen again, won't it?" I nodded. "I'm afraid so."
"And one of these times it isn't going to shift, and that'll be the end of him."
He had gone very pale.
"That's about it, Roddy. I'll have to get that pebble out."
"But how?"
"Cut into the larynx. And right now, it's the only way."
"All right." He swallowed.
"Let's get on. I don't think I could stand it if it went down again."
I knew what he meant. My knees had begun to shake, and I had a strong conviction that if Jake collapsed once more, then so would I. I seized a pair of scissors and clipped away the hair from the ventral surface of the larynx. I dared not use a general anaesthetic, and infiltrated the area with local before swabbing with antiseptic. Mercifully, there was a freshly boiled set of instruments lying in the sterilizer, and I lifted out the tray and set it on the trolley by the side of the table. "Hold his head steady," I said hoarsely, and gripped a scalpel. I cut down through skin, fascia, and the thin layers of the sternohyoid and the omohyoid muscles, till the ventral surface of the larynx was revealed. This was something I'd never done to a live dog before, but desperation abolished any hesitancy, and it took me only another few seconds to incise the thin membrane and peer into the interior. And there it was. A pebble right enough, grey and glistening and tiny, but big enough to kill. I had to fish it out quickly and cleanly, without pushing it into the trachea. I leant back and rummaged in the tray till I found some broad-bladed forceps, then I poised them over the wound. Great surgeon's hands, I felt sure, didn't shake like this. Nor did such men pant as I was doing. But I clenched my teeth, introduced the forceps, and my hand magically steadied as I clamped them over the pebble. I stopped panting, too. In fact, I didn't breathe at all as I bore the shiny little object slowly and tenderly through the opening and dropped it with a gentle rat-at on the table.
"Is that it?"
asked Roddy, almost in a whisper.
"That's it."
I reached for a needle and suture silk.
"All is well now."
The stitching took only a few minutes, and by the end of it Jake was bright-eyed and alert, paws shifting impatiently, ready for anything. He seemed to know his troubles were over. Roddy brought him back in 10 days to have the stitches removed. It was, in fact, the very morning he was leaving the Derby district, and after I had picked the few loops of silk from the nicely healed wound, I walked with him to the front door while Jake capered round our feet. On the pavement outside Skeldale House, the ancient pram stood in all its high, rusted dignity. Roddy pulled back the cover. "Up, boy," he murmured, and the big dog leapt effortlessly into his accustomed place. Roddy took hold of the handle with both hands, and as the autumn sunshine broke suddenly through the clouds, it lit up a picture which had grown familiar and part of the daily scene. The golf jacket, the open shirt and brown chest, the handsome animal sitting up looking around him with natural grace. "Well, so long, Roddy," I said. "I suppose you'll be around these parts again." He turned and I saw that smile again. "Aye, reckon I'll be back." He gave a push and they were off, the strange vehicle creaking, Jake swaying gently as they went down the street. The memory came back to me of what I had seen under the cover that night in the surgery. The haversack, which would contain his razor, towel, soap and a few other things, the packet of tea in the thermos, and something else, a tiny dog collar. Could it have belonged to Jake as a pup, or to another loved animal? It added a little more mystery to the man, and explained other things too. The farmer had been right. All Roddy possessed was in that pram. And it seemed it was all he desired, too, because as he turned the corner and disappeared from my view, I could hear him whistling.